It is Monday, September the 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, Turkey says it's cleared IS along the border with Syria.
That will be a major blow to their ability to rearm and to get personnel through.
President Obama at the G20 summit on climate change agreement.
We are here together because we believe that for all the challenges that we face, the growing threat of climate change could define the contours of this century more dramatically than any other challenge.
And also ahead, Mother Teresa canonized at a ceremony in Rome. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Turkey says Turkish-backed rebels battling Islamic State extremists on the Syrian border have driven IS fighters from the last remaining strongholds along a 90-kilometer stretch of borderland. VOA's Victor Beatty asked University of New South Wales regional analyst Anthony Billingsley if this is good news.
Anything that sort of puts Islamic State back on its heels must be considered good news, I think. On the other hand, Turkey's involvement with its two-pronged approach, one attacking the Kurds and one attacking the Islamic State, further complicates the situation along the border. I hope what it means is that the Turks have finally abandoned reasonably active support, indirect and direct support for Islamic State, and that will be a major blow to their ability to rearm and to get personnel through. So that'll be very important. The fighters that are working with the Turks are variously described as secular and Islamist groups, and I suspect that a number of those groups are only marginally better than Islamic State in terms of their respective human rights and that sort of issue. So there's a problem there. The Turks have the best capacity of anybody, I suppose, in the region, including the U.S. in this respect, because they've got everything there, a very large and well-trained armed forces, the Air Force, their armor, that sort of thing, which they can bring to bear. So that's a very significant contribution to fighting Islamic State, if that's what they confine themselves to. But as I said, the Kurdish element is a real complication.
Is the 10-day Turkish offensive in northern Syria, has it accomplished its goals? Is it over?
This remains to be seen. Islamic State has this ability to be driven out of an area and then pop back in again. And they can either just concentrate on making raids or they can actually try something more substantial. And it depends, I suppose, on how important the border area is to Islamic State.
There are also reports that government forces from Damascus and their allies have laid siege again to rebel-held eastern Aleppo Sunday. This has been a real seesaw battle for this city, and it's an important battle.
It is an important battle. I think a lot of people were surprised that when the government's first siege a few weeks ago was fairly quickly driven back or broken, and the rebels even approached on a significant part of the city that's held by the government side. But this looks like, well, a couple of things. One, that the U.S. and Russia were engaged in negotiations to try to come up with what I think is the essential thing in the whole process, a political agreement between the two of them as to how this thing was going to be stopped. And that seems to have fallen apart. And as that's happened, the Russians, I think, have increased their support for the Syrian government. And now we're seeing the siege being reimposed. And we saw when the original siege was imposed, the U.N., pleading desperately for access with supplies and medical support and that sort of thing. And we're going to get into the same problem again of no access to the city. Up to 1.5, 2 million people, including both sides of the city. And I suppose the government, the majority on the government side won't be quite so affected. But it's going to be another terrible continuation of this humanitarian catastrophe.
Anthony Billingsley is a professor of Middle East politics and international law at the University of New South Wales. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. And among the other stories we're following here on The Voice of America, South Sudan agreeing to a new UN-backed peacekeeping force, the Taliban warning India over military aid to Afghanistan, and saving eastern gorillas from extinction. There's more on that at our website, voanews.com, and always on the VOA mobile app. Chinese President Xi Jinping officially opened a two-day summit Sunday of the world's major economies, the so-called Group of 20, often called the G20. Earlier, Mr. Xi and President Obama met to talk about a wide array of issues on which they hope to cooperate, and those include security, trade, and matters of health. They also announced their governments had submitted documents committing them to carrying out the Paris Climate Agreement. Mr. Obama spoke to reporters afterwards.
We are here together because we believe that for all the challenges that we face, the growing threat of climate change could define the contours of this century more dramatically than any other challenge. One of the reasons I ran for this office was to make sure that America does its part to protect this planet for future generations. Over the past 7.5 years, we've transformed the United States into a global leader in the fight against climate change. But this is not a fight that any one country, no matter how powerful, can take alone. That's why last December's Paris Agreement was so important. Nearly 200 nations came together as a strong, enduring framework to set the world on a course to a low-carbon future. And someday we may see this as the moment that we finally decided to save our planet.
And on the first day of the summit, President Xi called for leaders of the United States, Germany, and other major economies to resist pressure to raise trade barriers. And he said the global economy is being threatened by rising protectionism and risk of high leverage being accumulated. Former Tsinghua University business professor, now at Columbia University, and a chief strategist at Silvercrest Asset Management, Patrick Chovanec, tells VOA Mr. Xi's warning that touches on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and globalization is justified.
There is a backlash. We see it in the United States in the campaign rhetoric, the rhetoric that surrounded the campaign and talk about rejecting TPP. From both candidates in the United States. Also in Europe, there's a backlash against globalization. So I think it is real. And I think that one of the problems, one of the underlying problems, is the imbalances in trade that have benefited both sides for a long time, but have really reached a point where they need to be corrected. And China is either going to be part of the problem or part of the solution there. So It's not just the tensions are being felt in the West, but China is definitely part of resolving this in a way that allows trade to continue and flourish.
This is day two of the G20 summit in Hangzhou, China, and President Obama is expected to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin, as well as continue to emphasize to China that it needs to adopt a more responsible role on the world stage and adhere to international norms, referencing China's activities in the South China Sea. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Mother Teresa was canonized on Sunday and is now a declared saint in the Roman Catholic Church. Her sainthood is special for many people, but for an Albanian composer and pianist, it is even more meaningful. He wrote a hymn dedicated to Mother Teresa, which was performed in Rome on the eve of the canonization. VOA's Mariama Diallo spoke to the composer and others about the life and legacy of this person, known for dedicating her life to helping the less fortunate on the streets of Calcutta, India.
Albanian composer Gens Tucuci says hearing that Mother Teresa was going to be a saint was a very special moment for him. He says, my first reaction was very physical. I had goosebumps. My hair was standing up on my head. I had a very proud feeling of being Albanian. I also thought that an Albanian did it. She dedicated her life to loving others. So why not me? Why not us? So pride in general, but also the duty of giving a little for the good of humanity. In that context, the watchword for me, and I hope it will be felt in the music, it's loving others. The introduction of Valse Celeste, played a year ago in Pristina, starts with two violins and a piano, he says, performed by the Kosovo Philharmonic Orchestra with top Albanian artists such as the famous sopranos Inva Mula and Ermonela Jaho, violinist Shkelzen Doli, and tenor Ram Lahai, among others. To many, she's known as Mother Teresa of Calcutta, but she was born Agnes Ganje Boyakju.
She was born in 1910, and the town that she was born in, Skopje, at that time was part of the Ottoman Empire, which collapsed and was divvied up in the aftermath of the First World War. She was actually of Albanian descent, and her family subsequently moved into the modern state of Albania a number of years after. She had left home in order to join the Sisters of Loreto, which were a missionary community. So when she left home at the age of 18, she ended up going to Ireland first, where she learned English, and then was assigned to a convent and a school in India at the foot of the Himalaya Mountains near Darjeeling, I guess.
Reverend Michael Witsack, Associate Professor of Liturgical Studies at the Catholic University of America in Washington, says one of Mother Teresa's legacies is her community, the Missionaries of Charity, whose members embody her convictions. Witsack says about 4,500 sisters worldwide are continuing the work of Mother Teresa, serving in places such as hospices, orphanages, as well as homes for people with AIDS and drug addictions, and unwed mothers.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Mother Teresa. Happy birthday.
Mother Teresa would have turned 106 years old when we visited a house in Southeast Washington being run by four nuns. The center feeds the needy, helps protect pregnant women who have nowhere to go, and is home to an aftercare program helping young students with their homework. In 2003, Mother Teresa was beatified by the late Pope Saint John Paul II. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
And turning now to U.S. presidential politics, where Republican candidate Donald Trump has edged closer to Democrat Hillary Clinton in public opinion polls. This comes just 3 weeks ahead of their first face-to-face debate. And then there is new attention to Clinton's handling of her emails through a private server when she was Secretary of State. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has released an account of its probe and an hours-long interview with Clinton. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman has been following developments and joins my colleague Jim Stevenson to talk about it all.
Jim, the saga of Hillary Clinton and her use of emails, her use of electronic communication during her time as President Barack Obama's first Secretary of State, is the story that will not go away. It has dogged her for months. And just this past Friday, the FBI released 58 pages of notes from 3.5 hours of interview that was conducted in July, shortly before the FBI concluded that no criminal wrongdoing had been committed, at least as far as the FBI could tell. But the FBI director came out with a fairly damning statement about carelessness on the part of Hillary Clinton in using a private email account to conduct official business, in storing data on a private server outside of the State Department. And of course, a great deal of that information was lost because that server was wiped clean. The FBI came out with 58 pages of notes, and there are things that that don't look terribly favorable. Here's the bottom line. The FBI doesn't know whether, in fact, any classified information fell into the wrong hands, be it Russia or China or anybody else, but it certainly can't rule it out. And there's nothing in these pages that is sort of a smoking gun as far as criminal activity. But there's nothing that's terribly reassuring about how the Democratic nominee for president handled sensitive information during her time as Secretary of State.
And repeatedly, Mrs. Clinton has said that she did not do anything wrong, at least knowingly. It doesn't paint a great picture for handling sensitive information, and that's what her opponents really are focusing on, is the way that this was handled, as opposed to any substance as to what was in the actual emails.
Jim, in a sense, it sort of undercuts Hillary Clinton's main claim to the presidency. She is the person of experience. She is the person of competence. She's the person who's been around the block. She knows how the system works. And when you have something that just sort of goes on and on that just won't go away, and it seems like every couple of weeks there's a new batch of emails that are released, some new detail in terms of how she conducted herself, it does tend to undercut her central argument that she is making to voters.
Talking about being fit for office, certainly Mrs. Clinton had the opportunity to discuss Donald Trump's recent trip to Mexico, where he has famously been talking about building a wall and having Mexico pay for it. And then the president of Mexico says, no, we're not paying for it.
Jim, there was something surreal about last Wednesday. I mean, here you have a Republican candidate for president who essentially waltzed to the Republican nomination on the idea that Mexico presents a threat and that America needs to build a wall to protect us from that threat, and needs to deport something on the order of 11 million undocumented immigrants from the United States. The Mexican president during the press conference said very little and sort of let Donald Trump dominate the stage, but then said that no, in fact, they had discussed it and that he had made clear to Donald Trump that Mexico will not be paying for any kind of wall. And that was something that the Clinton campaign definitely picked up on.
That is VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. Well, now it's time to see what's trending online with my colleague G. Abby Lee. Hey, G, you know, I'd like to get this online reaction to the so-called snub of President Obama when he arrived in China for the G20 summit.
Hi, Steve. Twitter users are sharing a short clip of a Chinese official telling his American counterpart during the commotion that this is our country, our airport. But it's unclear whether the official knew Ambassador Rice is not with a press corps, but a high-level public servant. You can also check out official tweets from the state-run People's Daily at G20_China, and people are also using hashtag G20China or hashtag G20Hangzhou.
Did Ambassador Rice tweet anything from China?
She did, but she sent out a rather formal one on Saturday stating that she has arrived in Hangzhou, but didn't really mention anything about the commotion.
Gee, why don't we move on to First Lady Michelle Obama? I understand that she visited with a group of college students right here in Washington.
That's right. She visited Howard University to speak at a back-to-school event. She was joined by celebrities Nick Cannon and Seth Meyers. The well-known university is on Twitter at Howard U and sent out this tweet. We couldn't be more proud of these hashtag HU2020 students who have been selected for at Florida's Reach Higher initiative. She told the students that going to college was one of the most impactful things she has done in her life.
I understand. Anything else out there trending?
Celebrated American singer Beyoncé turned 35 Sunday, and people have been using hashtag HappyBirthdayBeyoncé on social media. I spend a little too much time watching all her iconic dance moves that people put together on social media, but I would argue that that was time well spent. That's all for me today. Steve?
Yeah, exactly. I understand. I have to say, I've spent a fair amount of time watching Beyoncé videos myself. Yeah. Many thanks, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and you can find our program, International Edition, on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
For the last 8 months, NASA's Dawn mission has been studying Ceres, the largest object in the asteroid belt, from a relatively low altitude. The spacecraft is currently sitting about 385 kilometers above the dwarf planet's surface. Over that time, the space probe has been sending a large quantity of data and images back to Earth, providing much-needed insight into the giant asteroid. Now, NASA wants to move Dawn from its low orbit to an altitude of about 1,460 kilometers to get a whole new look at Ceres. The U.S. Space Agency says that Dawn's prime mission ended back on June 30th and that it had beaten all of its scientific goals at Ceres and another dwarf planet, Vesta. NASA has since extended Dawn's mission so that it can continue to study the giant asteroid, but from a new and different perspective. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. So good to have you with us today. We're going to step aside now and look at something from the world of music.
About 2 years ago, we had a hit in America with this song off an album called Abandoned Luncheonette, and it's called She's Gone.
That's Daryl Hall, who along with John Oates has been honored with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. They began their band, Hall & Oates, in Los Angeles with hits like She's Gone.
Everybody's high on consolation. Everybody's trying to tell me what is right for me. Yeah. My daddy tried to bomb me with a sermon.
Hall spoke at the presentation of the star.
You know, the early days of television, the pioneers of television, they're represented here. People like Phil Silvers and Groucho Marx and Jackie Gleason, these are the people I feel like, wow, I'm part of this, you know? And it's like, wow, it's sort of, I have to say this is a bit of a surprise because I didn't know this was going to happen very long ago. It just sort of... Rock on, man. I love Hollywood Boulevard.
Back in the morning, look in the mirror. Look in the mirror. Born as a toothbrush hanging in the stands. In the stand, in the sand. My face ain't looking any younger.
Eurythmics singer Dave Stewart joined the 70s and 80s hitmakers Hall & Oates for the ceremony outside the Musicians Institute in Hollywood.
You know, it's very surreal to be stood on Hollywood Boulevard all together, you know?
It's weird.
But on the other hand,
Probably their whole life has been surreal like mine since the first song they wrote, and that's what creativity is all about.
Every Time You Go Away is another of Hall & Oates' chart toppers. The musical duo from Philadelphia has sold an estimated 40 million records throughout their career, making them the third best-selling musical group of all time. John Oates told the crowd gathered along Hollywood Boulevard, "Getting the star on the Walk of Fame is special."
Why do we lose so many teams?
It's an honor to be here. It's an honor to be part of the great Sidewalk of Fame. You know, we came out here in the mid-70s. We actually came out here in the early 70s, and we were able to actually get our first record contract by auditioning for a guy named Earl McGrath in a little cottage off Santa Monica Boulevard.
You can't see, we got everything going on and on and on. Every time you go away, you take a piece of me with you, with you. Every time you go away, take a piece of me with you, with you.
Hall & Oates are still out touring. In fact, they're with Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, singing many of their hits, including Every Time You Go Away.
Doesn't mean that much.
They fell into a lot of genres, R&B, pop, rock. Some people thought, well, it just, you name it. They did sound good, still do, I've been told. I haven't heard them recently, but sounding good there. Thanks, everyone, for listening to The Voice of America today. I hope you'll stay tuned. Latest world news is straight ahead. Our director is Tracy Carter. Our engineer is Chaz Hall. I'm Steve Norman. We hope you have a great Monday. Now a little bit more of Hall & Oates.
An editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the first Monday of September every year, America pauses to honor its workers and the contributions they make to our nation's strength and prosperity. The notion that work is valued, and even noble, dates to the ancients. "Seest thou a man diligent in his labor?" the book of Proverbs asks. "He shall stand before kings." In the United States, the belief goes back well over a century. As a holiday, the Labor Day celebration began in the 1880s in New York City with an effort by labor unions to demonstrate the numbers, strength, and spirit of working men and women. They organized parades and rallies and used the demonstrations to press for new laws to benefit workers, such as standardizing the 8-hour workday. The movement spread to other cities, and in 1894, Congress made it a national holiday honoring all American workers. The association with trade and labor unions has declined over the years. Today, for most people, the holiday represents the last long weekend of summer, a time to relax and spend time with family and friends. There are still parades and rallies, particularly in election years, and also sporting events and picnics. For many, Labor Day means a no-Labor Day before the change of seasons and start of a new school year. Over time, work in the U.S. itself has changed. More Americans now are occupied in offices and services than who toil on the factory floor. The connection between the holiday and the nation's workers remains real, though, as recognition of the source of so much of America's economic and social achievements.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4.